From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, some common sense advice regarding the rise of insect-borne diseases in Wisconsin.
Then a new app is helping Wisconsin researchers learn more about how Lyme disease is transmitted locally.
Later, award-winning dress designer and Milwaukee native Donna Rico says there shouldn't be any reason why the next design star couldn't come from Wisconsin as well.
These days, really anyone, providing they have the spirit and the talent and the idea. I mean, I think it's all about having that idea that you believe in, and that's different than what the next person is doing.
And as the trend of raising backyard chickens grows in Milwaukee, one local business owner has made it her mission to help.
I try to make it easy and take all the guesswork out for people, because what I found is what you read on the internet is pretty scary, and it isn't like that.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Last week, a dead bird in Milwaukee tested positive for West Nile virus. Public health officials say that officially means we should be more vigilant about mosquitoes that could be carrying the disease here.
But disease-carrying mosquitoes are not the only potential human health nuisance. Ticks are also abundant in Wisconsin. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bent spoke with several experts in the field who shared some common sense advice.
Ann Christensen knows a lot about the West Nile virus and how mosquitoes fit into its transmission. Christensen, who is the department's health director, says it starts with a dead animal, such as the crow picked up and tested last week in Milwaukee County.
Mosquitoes can bite birds and then in turn acquire the virus and then transmit it back to humans. When mosquitoes bite humans, they don't acquire West Nile. Birds are the ones that transmit the virus from mosquito to mosquito.
The infectious disease first appeared in the United States in 1999.
It started in the southern United States and has slowly crept upward to the northern regions. And now it's really all over the United States. So it's been one of those things that's been tracked from the south to the north as the climate is changing.
Wisconsin's Department of Health Services started monitoring birds, horses, mosquitoes, and humans in 2001. A year later, the department confirmed the first human infection. Christensen says statewide in 2017.
We had 51 cases of human West Nile virus. That's an increase over the last 5 years from previous years. We did have another spike in 2012. So the cases are cyclical, but one thing to note when I look back at our information from last year is this is a little bit earlier where we're seeing the dead bird. In previous years, we've reported in August and actually as late as September, our first bird testing positive. So this being the end of July is a little bit earlier than previous years, which could be an indicator of earlier mosquito activity and more mosquito activity, which we do also see.
But Christensen says the last thing she wants to do is raise undue alarm. She says the majority of people, about 80%, bitten by West Nile virus carrying mosquitoes will not get sick. Close to 20% might experience symptoms including fever, headache, muscle ache, rash, and fatigue. But Christensen says it's the remaining vulnerable 1% for whom the virus can be life-threatening.
Usually people with compromised immune systems or the elderly. Yes, it can be. Some of the side effects or symptoms can be encephalitis, meningitis, coma, and then it can be fatal for some, yeah.
But is it treatable?
The best treatment is symptom management. So treating the fever, the headache, the muscle aches. There's no antibiotics that would be beneficial for people with West Nile virus. Unfortunately, it's much more treating the symptoms of the disease.
So Christensen advises to be on the safest side. Before heading outdoors, apply repellent, such as DEET, or if you prefer a more natural approach.
Oil of lemon eucalyptus is a repellent that's been shown to be effective. So there are more options available for people for wearing repellent. But if people are not interested in that, wearing long long-sleeve shirt, long pants, just covering up so that the mosquitoes aren't able to get through the clothing is also a reasonable strategy.
As for reducing mosquitoes lurking close to home, she advises people to make sure window screens are in good shape. You can also avoid the unintentional breeding of mosquitoes by emptying water in wheelbarrows and wading pools. I asked Jennifer Zaspel, head of zoology at the Milwaukee Public Museum, to fill me in on a different disease-carrying creature, the tick. She passes a vast ethanol-stored collection, including damselflies and spiders, before pulling out a neatly labeled jar.
Some vials just have one. Others, you know, may have more than one specimen in each. You can see here is a big engorged female. And so the ticks in this scientific group are the hard ticks.
Zaspel says most tick species in nature belong to the hard-shelled tick family.
So, and that's just over 700 worldwide and probably between 90 and 100 in the United States.
Just four species are known to make Wisconsin home.
The first one is the Lone Star tick. This tick showed up in about 2012 and 2013. I wouldn't necessarily call this species common.
It's the black-legged, otherwise known as deer tick, that presents a growing public health issue.
And so this is our Lyme disease vector.
Lyme disease is caused by bacterium transmitted to humans through the bite of infected ticks. Symptoms can include fever and headaches. If not treated, infection can spread to joints, the heart, and the nervous system. Not a pretty prospect. And ticks are stealthy creatures, although they can't fly.
They've really become perfect at sensing their hosts and the environment. And they are able to smell you and sense temperature changes. And some ticks hang out on blades of grass, perfectly poised, just waiting for that host to walk by and land on it.
Zaspel suggests arming yourself with knowledge.
Get online. There are some really excellent resources out there. The Russell Labs at UW-Madison have a fantastic website with identification tools. You can see pictures of the ticks that we've talked about today at the various life stages. And if you want to send specimens in or take a picture and send a photograph in, they have folks who provide the service of IDing these ticks for you. And, you know, if you find a tick on you, toss it in the freezer in a Ziploc bag, and that way it could be tested later, especially if you find yourself, you know, showing symptoms. And I think because some of these illnesses are becoming a lot more prevalent, just having that awareness, I have a fever, I have a rash, what's going on here, and considering the possibility that you may have a tick-borne disease.
Zaspel and her team are collaborating with fellow scientists both in-state and around the country to digitize and share tick collections data.
As the data comes in and as the specimens come in, I think we'll see more possibilities for control options in the future.
But until research results in a biological control or perhaps a vaccination, Zaspel recommends the kind of common sense precautions her own family, human and canine, employ.
When we come in from hiking or doing things outside, we always take a shower, and you can kind of feel your head a little bit easier when your hair is wet, and helping each other do those checks. And then certainly trying to let the dogs go for a swim too, so that we can really feel whether or not they have anything. And we also religiously, even in the winter months, make sure that our pets have preventative medications against fleas and ticks.
Centers for Disease Control recommendations include treating clothing and gear and using EPA-registered insect repellents. You'll find a link to that information attached to the story at WUWM.com. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
As Susan's story pointed out, experts advise people do a thorough check of their bodies after spending time outdoors. And while you're doing that, you could help some local researchers learn more about how to prevent the spread of Lyme disease.
Susan Paskowitz is a professor and chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison, and she's one of the researchers working on the Tick app. The app invites users to keep a diary with information about possible tick sightings, encounters, and bites.
Paskowitz spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in June about her research and the history of Lyme disease in Wisconsin.
The first case was probably back in the 1960s, and that was a human case where it was really obvious from the description of the symptoms of this person that he had Lyme disease, although they didn't call it that. It took a few years before Lyme was discovered in Old Lyme, Connecticut, so that was the middle 1970s. And then a few more years past that into about the early 1980s before we realized what the disease agent was and that the ticks were really important in terms of transmission. And a lot of that work was done on the East Coast, but of course we have the same ticks here, and so it was about that time in the early 1980s that we realized that our ticks also were infected and that people, more people than we had known, were getting sick.
So one of the questions I have just about Lyme disease in general is really, why do our ticks here in Wisconsin, in the East Coast, why do they have Lyme disease while those in the South and some other places, they don't?
Right. So that's a really wonderful and interesting biological story because it is the same tick. We call them Ixodes scapularis, the scientific name, or the black-legged tick, or the deer tick is probably more familiar to people in Wisconsin. And certainly deer ticks are really abundant here in the upper Midwest and Wisconsin and Minnesota and also along the East Coast, you know, now all the way up into Maine and really converging now. So we're starting to see them in lots of places where they didn't used to be, you know, Michigan, Indiana, and so on. But they also occur down in the southern United States. The difference seems to be that the behavior of this tick down there where it's hotter and drier is different from the behavior up here. And that may have a genetic component, so there may be some things that are about the populations that are a little bit different. But what we see is that up here, the immature stages, the nymphal stages and the larval stages are going to be up sitting on the grass and the vegetation waiting for a host to come by, and then they're going to grab that host. And so they're just out there, you know, waiting for us to brush up against them. In the South, they just don't see that. When they go out and try to collect the ticks, they're not up. They're not actively looking in that same kind of way. What we think is they're probably down in the leaf layer, actually moving around more underground where it's more humid and looking for things like lizards that are buried down in there at night and feeding on down. So just a little bit of a difference in the biology of the tick is making a big difference in where we see disease.
So tell me a bit about the tick app. When did this project start?
Well, this is a collaboration between the Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease here in the Upper Midwest and the Northeast Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, which is housed in Cornell. But our primary partners out there are actually some researchers at Columbia, and they started developing an app a couple years ago. We then began talking with them about some possibilities for joint projects comparing Lyme transmission in their area and in our area, and realized that they had felt that their app development was a fail. They only had, I think, 10 or 11 people who picked up the app, and we thought that maybe with some of the resources here at UW-Madison, we could develop something that would be a little bit more appealing to people. And indeed, with the rollout of the app already, I think we've got several hundred people who've signed up for it, so we're really pleased about that.
What kind of things does the app ask of participants? How do you participate with the app?
Yeah, so the app is designed as a research tool, but it's also designed as an educational tool. And so when you download the app, the first thing that will happen is you'll be asked to sign a consent form. So it will describe what's going to happen in terms of surveys and information we're going to collect. You sign off on that. And then you will do a kind of a pre-survey where we ask questions about the kind of properties, features of your property, aspects of your pets, what kind of activities you do outside. So you fill out this pre-survey, which for a lot of us has only taken about 5 or 10 minutes to do. And then what happens is each day for a period of about 2 weeks in the peak transmission season, which is right now, you're going to get a reminder at the end of the day to fill out a tick diary. And that tick diary will ask you whether you encountered a tick. And if you did, then you go on and answer a few more questions about what you were doing and where you were when you encountered that tick. And if not, then you say no and you're all done. So just a few seconds that way. The other thing that is part of this is that if people should get a tick on their person and they want to report it outside of that diary window, we do have a report a tick function. So you can go in and take a picture, you can send it to us, and you can tell us what you were doing again when you picked that tick up. And that could be really valuable as we're trying to understand more about people's activity and the environments in which they're being exposed to Lyme and the other pathogens transmitted by these deer ticks.
Yeah, what kind of information do you hope to glean from this? I mean, you were just saying, you know, activities that people are doing, where they might be when they see these ticks. What can we learn from knowing these things?
I think one of the things we're hoping is to do this comparison with the East Coast, because traditionally there, you know, they've really thought that people are getting sick as a result of exposure in their own backyards. And that's really different. You know, when I first came to Wisconsin, the idea was that you went to your cabin up in the Northwoods, and maybe you were hiking or fishing or clearing brush on your property, and those were the kinds of activities that were quite different here from what people there were experiencing. We're not sure that that's true, and we really could use the help of people in Wisconsin now sharing with us more about where they're finding deer ticks. So this is one of our core goals, is to try to understand, are you picking them up when you're mowing the grass? Could you possibly be encountering deer ticks when you're out there working in your garden, whether it's a vegetable garden or ornamentals? Maybe it is when you're out there working along the edge and doing brush clearing in your property is a place where you might be at higher risk. But those are the kinds of things where we would really hope to get more information, because that would then help us think a lot more about how are we going to control transmission of disease. If it's on your property, we have ways then that we can think about trying to implement. If you're getting exposed solely as a result of hiking in our wonderful Northwoods, then we have to do really different things, because we're obviously not going to go out and do treatments in the woods. That's going to be much more than a personal, an education on what people need to do every day to protect themselves.
So recognizing that we're still at really in kind of the beginning stages of this project, is there anything that we've learned so far?
You know, one of the things that we've been doing to implement the app is going out and talking a lot more with people. So we're ecologists and biologists, and a lot of what we do is go out and collect ticks, and we collect small mammals, and we don't interact so much with the public. But this app has kind of put us out of our comfort zone a little bit. We've gone out and worked with several communities in central Wisconsin, up near Minocqua and over in Eau Claire, down closer to the Madison area. And what we're finding is that people are really interested in receiving information about ticks and in helping us, you know, in participating. So they recognize the problem and they want to be a part of trying to figure out what some of the solutions might be.
So when you are talking to people about ticks, what do you tell them about avoiding them, about places where they might be hanging out?
Right. So, you know, from our work, I think the places where we think the highest risk are will be in wooded areas, because these ticks are really susceptible to drying out. So if you are in woods and you're walking down the hard pack on a trail, you're fine. You know, usually there aren't going to be a lot of ticks out in that kind of environment. As soon as you step off into the grass and the weeds a little bit on the side, though, then the deer ticks can be much more abundant in those locations. So I give people those kinds of warnings and then talk a bit about, you know, tucking your pants in your sock or using a repellent. You know, an insect repellent can be very helpful in that environment. There are also ways that you can treat your clothing. And very importantly, just remembering that at the end of the day, you need to take a shower and do that very careful tick check to look for them, because that's the primary thing that we would hope, right, is that you can get it off before it ever has a chance to transmit disease to you.
And if you have been bitten by a tick, what do you suggest people do?
So that's very dependent on how long the tick has been attached, and it's very dependent on what kind of tick it is. One of the things we're learning is that, you know, while many people are able to tell the difference between a deer tick and a wood tick, not everybody. So people are sending us pictures through the tick app, and sometimes we're realizing that these are actually wood ticks, and so there's no real worry with those in terms of disease transmission. So that's a good thing, right? But if you have the other tick on your person, if it is a deer tick, and it's been on for 24 hours, 36 hours, then you have this potential for Lyme transmission. If it's been on for shorter periods, there still is potential for transmission of other diseases. They have a couple of choices then. You can be very careful and alert for symptoms over the next couple of weeks and go see your physician immediately. In that case, I would actually save the tick and take it with me so they would know what you were exposed to. Or you can go and talk to your doctor right away, because sometimes it's appropriate to get a prophylactic treatment of antibiotics. In other words, a preventative treatment of an antibiotic if you've had a tick attached for a 24 to 36 hour period.
Going back to the tick app, when do you hope to have more concrete results from the project?
So we should start analyzing data probably by the end of July. So we're in the peak period of data collection now and over the next, say, 4 weeks. Usually we still see a lot of tick activity into the first couple weeks in July, and it begins to tail off a bit after that. So hopefully around the first part of August, we'll start doing some analysis. We're all very curious, so we can barely stand not looking at the data yet just to see what might be emerging. But we are receiving a lot of pictures from people, because that's one of the functions of the app, is that you can take a picture and send it to us for an identification and some advice. And that's been a really interesting process as well. So we're already kind of analyzing what we're seeing with that.
Susan Paskowitz is the chair of the entomology department at UW-Madison, and she is one of the researchers behind the Tick app. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in June, and you can find a link to more about her research and the app at WUWM.com.
Up next, we meet an award-winning fashion designer who is returning to Milwaukee, the place it all started for her. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When you think of the fashion centers of the world, cities like New York and Paris and Milan often come to mind. And while it's true that the most influential design houses are in those cities, fashion designers themselves come from all over, like, for example, Milwaukee.
That was the case with Donna Rico, who got her start in the fashion department at Mount Mary University. She went on to found a dress company that earned fans the likes of First Lady Michelle Obama.
More recently, though, Rico sold that company and spent time figuring out what would come next. Well, it turns out that her next act takes a page from her first act. Rico will return, in part, to Mount Mary, where she will become an executive fellow in the fashion department, regularly spending time with students at her alma mater.
Rico was back in town this summer, and we met up with her on the Mount Mary campus on Milwaukee's west side. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Oh, I'm so happy to do it. I'm so excited with this new position, and I think that I'm just anxious to share what I hope to be doing here with for the school and the students at Mount Mary.
So let me ask you, why is this the time to reestablish your ties with Mount Mary and Milwaukee? Not that you have ever, you know, completely distanced yourself, but you say it's been a while since you've really spent any time here. Why was this the time to reconnect the way you're doing?
Well, things changed for me about 4 years ago. I stopped working in the industry in New York. I'm very proud of the brand I built, and I left it in good standing, and I wish them well in continuing to develop clothing for that label. But when I stopped working, I realized that I still loved to follow fashion, and I read about fashion every day. I love the creativity, the business, and I've been storing all of these ideas and articles and things in my drive, and I was contacted by Mount Mary about 6 months ago, and they were looking to fill a chair position here at the school, and they were asking for my thoughts and maybe for me to share my network in order for them to draw some candidates. And as we talked, I realized, and after looking at the job description, I realized that this is something that maybe I could help them with, and I wasn't looking to do something, to make a move. I still live in New York, and But I felt, well, with technology these days, there's things I can do from here to help them, and certainly I'd love to be in the classroom and help critique and such. So they were very patient, and we had a couple of meetings, and we came up with this position that I think really speaks to what I hope to be doing for the school.
Can you think about the time when you were a student? I mean, can you talk about what drew you as someone who grew up in this area to fashion in the first place?
Well, I was always creative as a kid, and as a student, I focused on art classes. I loved art. I loved drawing. I loved ceramics in high school. When it was time to think about college, I started in the art program at UWM, and loved it. I loved doing the, you know, learning about graphics and painting and drawing, life drawing, and really, really loved all of it. At the same time, I was sewing, and I would, you know, sew from patterns, and I would get very creative with the fabrics to the patterns, and I would change things, and I realized that, you know, maybe I could combine my two loves. So fashion design was the concept, and I discovered that Mount Mary had a fashion design program. I had an interview. They looked at my portfolio, and they accepted me. So after about 2 years at UWM, I switched over to Mount Mary and studied in their fashion program.
Well, and how did the program here at Mount Mary kind of, I don't know, shape what you maybe wanted from life and from that world?
Well, I didn't realize what I wanted at that point. As a local girl, I thought, well, maybe I'll have a dress shop and I'll make clothes for people here in Milwaukee. I didn't have any plans to leave. And what happened when I started with here at Mount Mary is I was introduced to so many concepts and so many possibilities in the world of fashion. The great thing that Mount Mary did back then, which inspired me to move to New York ultimately, was to introduce me to so many professionals from the industry, from New York mostly, and also local at the time. There was more manufacturing here in Milwaukee at that point. And the people that came in were just, I was like a sponge. I was so inspired, you know, to hear them tell their stories. And I started to realize that, gee, this kind of makes sense, that maybe I could take this further than staying here.
It takes a certain amount of a leap of faith, if you will, to be able to go from being a 20-something getting out of college and saying, okay, well, I'm going to go to New York and we'll just see what happens.
Well, yes, it does. And I credit my family for supporting me in that effort. Certainly, before I moved to New York, I lived at home. I commuted to school every day. But when I realized the potential that I had, I had entered a national design competition when I was here as a student. And the first year I placed 14th out of about 1,500 entrants across the country. And the second year I placed second. And so after I won that award, I went to New York to collect the award at the event that they held. And it was judged by people like Calvin Klein and Bernadine Morris, who was the fashion reporter for the Times, and all kinds of fashion people. It was sponsored by the ILGWU, if you remember that, International Ladies Garment Workers.
Yeah.
And anyway, I realized that I had something that maybe should go further than staying here in Milwaukee, and I just had this drive within me to do something more. And even back then, I was reading about the designers. I would read Women's Wear Daily every day, and I would target certain designers and look at what the products they did, and I scheduled interviews with them when I went to New York for this event, and they looked at my portfolio and they were positive. Of course, being from Milwaukee was a bit of a challenge. I didn't have that New York experience that students at FIT or Parsons might have. But I did have the talent that they recognized. And so it was enough for me to come back to Milwaukee and make a plan to, you know, take this adventure and make the move and see what happens. And I had a different plan when I moved. I thought I would work for another company. And you know, learn the business, as they say. But I ended up starting to wear some of the clothes that I was making. I had a cousin who had a art gallery in New York, and he would invite me to openings, and I would wear my own things. And some of his clients would come up to me and ask, well, what are you wearing? That's so new and different, and it really is unique. Can you make me one of those? And really, that's how it started.
Wow.
I think with that confidence the fact that I had the ability to put my thoughts in order, and also it was a lot of hard work.
Right, that's the underrated part of this. There's a lot of thought that genius just is, but genius right. also requires a ton of work too.
And I think anyone who's thinking about being an entrepreneur in any business has to realize that it's more than just an idea. You can have a great idea, but if you don't have the ability to put the time and the effort and the resilience to make it through the times of failure, you know, certainly I experienced that, and I did still up, you know, every day. But you have to get through it, and you have to respect it. And I tried to learn from it and apply it to my, you know, things that happened after. And I think having that positive attitude helps in many ways in life.
Well, but at the same time, there seems to be within that hard work a whole lot of creativity that has to go into, you know, how do I put that work into practice? I'm not sure that most people would say, well, I'm going to wear the stuff that I have designed to gallery openings and put that in their business plan.
Well, that sort of just happened. I mean, that's what I had in my closet. And so, you know, I guess, yes, it was sort of serendipitous that I was able to promote my talent by wearing it. It wasn't like I was an artist and had to show my portfolio. And meanwhile, remember, back when I started, there was no internet, there were no computers, there was no social media. So it was really, you know, you had to go out and you had to do stuff, you had to be seen, and you had to present yourself in a way that that you could connect with people. And I think that's really another reason that I had success early on, is that I love to talk to people. I feel like, you know, you can learn so much by walking up to someone and having a conversation. So I think all of that helped me have the ability to just, you know, start out with nothing, work very hard, and, you know, make small steps, but enough right steps, more right than wrong. I made the mistakes when, you know, I was little and again learned from them. I developed great relationships as I went along, starting with small specialty stores who would, you know, order 5 or 6 pieces, which I would sew myself in the beginning. You know, as the business grew, I was able to hire sewers, and finally found a factory that would do cutting and sewing as the orders got bigger. That's really how it all started.
You mentioned when you first went to New York, it was difficult for someone from Milwaukee who went to school here, who didn't have those New York fashion connections. Do you think, is that still the case for people who come from elsewhere to New York?
Oh, not so much. I think that, you know, with technology and there's so many more opportunities to see and to share for students and to become more aware of their opportunities in other parts of the world. It's not, certainly moving to New York is not an easy task, okay? You have to have a plan. You have to, again, be willing to work hard and make your way. But I think these days that really anyone, providing they have the spirit and the talent and the idea, I mean, I think it's all about having that idea that you believe in, and that's different than what the next person is doing. In fashion is very competitive in education and in the business and the creativity. And that's what I thrived on that. There were always many dresses in the market. Why did they buy a Donna Rico dress? It's because it fit them, it flattered them, it was comfortable. And people would look at the woman wearing the dress and not just say, oh, that's a great dress, but they'd say, you look great in that dress. And what woman doesn't want to hear that?
I have an interview in a few days with a woman who, she's the author of what's subtitled A Midlife Coming of Age Story, a woman named Pamela Druckerman. She lives in Paris. She's American. She and her English husband raised their kids in Paris. But there's a chapter on understanding what she wants from her wardrobe in her late 40s.
Okay.
And the line that really stuck with me, she writes, anxiety is at the core of Americans' relationship with fashion. That we, as Americans, put a lot of pressure on ourselves in terms of what we want out of the perfect garments. Do you subscribe to that notion, and Is that just the way it is, or as a designer, is that something that you work to change?
Well, personally, I have that feeling. I'm always very serious about what I'm going to wear when I, every day. I can go, be going out into the garden. Well, now should I wear these shorts or this chambray shirt? And what should I, how should I protect myself from the poison ivy? But, you know, I think about that all the time. And I think I have a comfortable relationship with my closet and my clothing. And, you know, I certainly I've been in the business a long time, and it was my business to make clothing that flattered the woman and hopefully gave her the confidence to wear a dress. You know, dresses is a whole nother psychological concept in clothing for women. I love talking to women in stores. When I was working and I would have trunk shows in the department stores, and I'd meet the customers, and I learned so much just from talking to them and seeing what their, you know, their issues were. A lot of it is psychological. It's not having the confidence to put on a dress, or if, again, if it doesn't fit, I can I can see why they would be a little nervous. But once, you know, my goal as a designer was to make something that would fit her and make her feel good. And once, you know, they start getting that feedback wearing these clothes, I think that's a big confidence builder.
Do you ever have occasion to sew anymore?
You know what? I do. I missed sewing all my years of working. I was creating, and I was, you know, handling fabrics, and but I was directing others to make the products. I ran a sample room where, you know, but I never really had to sit down at the machine myself. And once I stopped doing that every day, I had the time and really the desire to get back at it. So I, about 2 years ago, I bought myself a new little sewing machine, and I am sewing again for myself. It's a challenge in that I miss having the ability to buy all kinds of fabrics and feel them that I used to have when I was working in the industry. Now I buy most things retail, obviously. And again, you can shop online for fabric and have many more options that way. But I love it. I love the idea of working with my hands and, you know, thinking about, again, what do I want to wear? And I think that I've always kind of been my own customer. And I think that's what also made me successful, is to look in my own closet and say, well, okay, this was fine, you know, 5 years ago, but now my figure has changed maybe, and I want to cover my arms rather than have sleeveless all the time. And those are the kinds of challenges, I think, as women mature, that makes it harder for them, certainly, to find clothing. But when you're sewing for yourself, you can just make it.
Well, Donna Rico, I have about 25,000 other questions I could ask you, but at this point, I'll just say thank you so much, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Fashion designer Donna Rico is a Milwaukee native, Mount Mary University graduate, and the founder of the dress company that's named for her. She was named last month as an executive fellow in the fashion department in Mount Mary School of Arts and Design. You can read more about her and her new role at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we look at a local business helping backyard chicken farmers in Milwaukee. More when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. As laws governing urban farming have been repealed around the area, more and more people have joined in on the growing trend of beekeeping and backyard chicken coops.
This comes as good news for Karen Krumenacher, the owner of Royal Roost. It's a local consulting service that offers to help backyard chicken farmers like herself. Krumenacher started the business more than 20 years ago at a time when keeping chickens in the city of Milwaukee was illegal.
Lucky for her, she lives in Pewaukee, which is where she met up with Lake Effect producer Joy Powers and intern Ben Benversi. They headed out to the Roost back in June to see just what it takes to be a backyard chicken farmer.
Even before you started consulting with people, what got you interested in chickens?
I think what it was is we moved out here from Milwaukee out to the beautiful Lake Country living area, and I was pregnant with my oldest, my first, And, you know, here we are. It didn't look anything like this. It was all wooded. And we had a Cocker Spaniel, and I thought, geez, you know, as much as we like being out, you know, beyond those woods was kind of scary. I wasn't sure what was out there. So I said, I think if I'm out here, it'd be nice to have ducks or chickens or something. So that back then is when Martha Stewart still had her like living program that was on primetime TV, which I was obsessed with watching. I watched her with a flock of 300 Americanas, which is how she got started with Sherwin-Williams, the painting business, because they lay eggs that are different shades of cream, khaki, brown, rose-colored, green-colored. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can do that. I can raise chickens. So it wasn't much of an afterthought. We headed up, went to Merton Feed Mill, because starting in February through the end of August, they carry all different breeds of chicks, pheasants, ducklings, goslings, guinea hens, you name it. So we went there and we picked up our first chicks and haven't looked back.
What happened, you know, more than 20 years ago that you went, this is something I want to do?
What happened is my husband is a patent attorney, and once my youngest was in school, he's like, all right, what kind of invention with chicken raising, backyard, kind of tool can you come up with? And I happened to be at Merton Feed Mill, who I have a great relationship with. That's who I get all my feed with. I was in there getting my supplies, and a guy came in and said, hey, Greg, I think I want to get into this chicken raising. What do I got to do? Well, Greg doesn't have 30 minutes of his time to, you know, fill the guy in on everything he needs, what to do. I hopped in my Suburban, was driving home, and the light bulb went on. And I was like, hey, I could be a chicken consultant. And so I came home, I chatted with my best friend. We came up with a logo. We put it together. Website was created, and here I am. Obviously, it was slow to start because it's such a niche, one-of-a-kind business. When I started it, it was just kind of on that cusp of being a trend, the chicken raising. So as any business, small little business, you're constantly reinventing yourself, what you can do, because when you're passionate about something, you really want to make it work. And I didn't want it to be a hobby. I wanted it to be a business.
20 years ago, of course, raising chickens in Milwaukee wasn't actually legal.
Yeah, no. They passed it, I think, like a year or two after I started the business.
Okay.
Wauwatosa came on board. There's various municipalities that are all on board now with chicken raising.
As you've seen, like, the changes happening, you know, in really the legal status of keeping chickens,
yeah.
Have you seen interest in it grow?
Yes. Oh, I think right now it's kind of at a high plateau. More urban agriculture, people are really concerned and interested, especially with young children, where their food is coming from, what is in their food. You know, a lot of people eat eggs. So I always consider chickens the pet with benefits. Great pets, but then yet you get an egg from them. So what a perfect pet.
Yeah.
So these are bantams. This is as big as they get. They're full size. So these are actually kind of perfect for city dwelling chicken raisers. They lay smaller eggs, but I actually think they produce eggs a little bit quicker than that 24 to 36 hour period. So I highly recommend something like this, you know, especially City of Milwaukee that has the ordinance for four. Versus the big standards like
yeah.
That.
The more classic chicken.
Yes. Yep. But those guys are pretty cute. It's fun to watch them. There's two roosters in there, so they're kind of the watch out for the girls. Very cute to watch them frolic around and interact with each other. And the boys will find bugs or grubs for the girls, and then they'll call them over and pretend like they're eating them, but they're not. Then they let the girls take over. This is Mr. Rockstar Handsome Turks. He is our heritage breed, Blue Slate. If anybody follows me on Facebook, they'll see Turks a lot. I take him to events. He was just out at Stonebank Farm Market last night. They had pizza night, and they asked if I'd bring him out. And he just, wherever there's people, he's there.
So I'm seeing a lot of these holes chickens are kind of sitting in.
They are getting deeper and deeper. So this is perfect. She's doing what's called dust bathing. To maintain their healthy feathers, they need to seek out natural dirt, and they kind of pack it around their feathers. And it's cooling as well, feels good. You know, just like when we shower and bathe, this is what they do in the dirt. And then they come out and they kind of shake and fluff, and you'll see dust go flying. But it is very important that they do that to maintain their healthy feathers.
So if you're someone who has a chicken coop in the city,
yes.
What kind of environment do you need? Because they need to dig a hole like this. They need to be able
They need to have access to dirt. It should be a 50-50 split of sun and shade. They don't need a lot of space. See the size of this coop?
Yeah, it's about the size of a child's playhouse.
As far as even outrun, it should just be kind of this area that includes a coop and a fenced-in run-in area for them to keep them contained. But they don't need a lot of space, especially if you get the right breeds. That's kind of key, is know your breeds. Know your breeds that are non-flighty, non-aggressive, good egg layers, winter hardy. These are all important factors when you want to dive into chicken raising. That's why I started the business. So not that I'm a know-it-all by any means, but I try to make it easy and take all the guesswork out for people, because what I found is what you read on the internet is pretty scary, and it usually doesn't happen. It isn't like that.
Now, when you say kind of scary, what are the kinds of things that people end up reading?
As far as mites, lice, you know, avian flu kind of things, salmonella, there's simple preventative measures that you can take in maintaining your healthy, friendly flock that doesn't necessarily pertain to what you're reading that's happening in year-round climates. It's different here.
So you have the Americanas, you have the lovely turks here.
Yes, there's some ducks.
Yeah, so what kinds of ducks? Do you get eggs from the ducks?
We do, and actually right now we have some very broody females that just love to stockpile the eggs, but we've done enough of the natural hatchling of ducklings that we just now take them, and I use them for baking or whatnot.
Nice.
So, yeah.
What's the difference between the eggs?
Duck eggs are a thicker, creamier consistency, really preferred for baking.
Okay.
You know, it's just like a fresh egg. If you have ever had fresh eggs, they actually taste. They actually have a flavor versus your store-bought. You know, my yolks are orange. They're not, you know, a matted, muted yellow. They're pretty much orange. And it's because the chickens naturally forage on bugs and grubs and weeds that just add to a higher protein content.
Now, if you're someone who's interested in maybe having ducks instead of chickens,
yeah.
What is that like?
I don't recommend, because ducks really are obsessed with water. They do something called face washing, where they get their bills in there and then they snort it out. It's just really messy. They're hard to keep in the winter. They take a bit longer to lay their eggs versus a chicken. They start to lay eggs anywhere between 4 to 6 months old, most breeds. Ducks are usually more 5+ months, could be even up to 7-8 months old. But yeah, that water thing is a for real thing, and it just gets to be kind of messy.
So harder for especially
yes.
urban dwellers.
Yes, yes.
Now, what are the biggest mistakes when it comes to raising chickens in an urban environment? What are the biggest mistakes that you see people making?
You know, it's easy to kind of get out of hand because it really is. Raising 2 to 4 chickens is nothing. It's easy. We started out with 4. The next year, we immediately went to 8 because they really don't require a lot of care and maintenance. Really, that's kind of it. I mean, everything with urban agriculture is awesome these days. I mean, chicken raising and gardening, beekeeping, it just makes sense that they all go together.
What are the biggest questions that you get from people when they're looking to get into keeping chickens in their yards, that they go, I'm really not sure how to navigate this part of it?
The biggest thing is predators. And the biggest predator you really have to deal with is going to be a hawk, because they're mostly out during the day. Here on our property, these tall pines, we have a nest in that tree and we have a nest down the way. They're red-tailed hawks. The worst time really is in the spring when they're feeding their young. They have their young in February and March. But as far as the coyote and fox, they're all roamers. They're not territorial, and they're more nocturnal. So at night, your chickens are cooped up in their cute little house. They're not out and about. I mean, you will have those strange situations, which don't happen that awesome, or frequently, that a coyote could be roaming through, or a fox den is somewhere close, and they get a whiff of chicken or hear the crowing or something. Sure, then they may be showing up, but I would not let that deter you from all the happiness that comes out of backyard chicken raising.
Now, of course, you have roosters here. If yes. You're someone who's in the city of Milwaukee, you're not legally allowed to have roosters.
Right, exactly.
What is the benefit of having a rooster versus just having the chickens?
Roosters are kind of your watchdog. So as far as predators, the hawks doing a flyby, they're going to let out a call like a... And that's kind of a siren for the girls. And I've seen it many times. They go running for the shrubs, something to take cover. And he'll still kind of be out there watching what the hawk's going to do. So he's a good watchdog for the girls. Like I previously mentioned, he'll be off. And if he finds something for the girls to eat on, he lets them know. But he doesn't partake himself. So he's very gentlemanlike to the girls, which is awesome to observe.
Do you have any questions that you'd like to add, Ben?
It seems like they're coexisting pretty peacefully now. Do you ever have any spats between the animals, or which ones maybe don't get along? Because I've seen dogs.
Great question.
And chickens. Sometimes it doesn't mix.
Yeah, that pecking order is a real thing. So, like in my case right now, so I have my rental chickens, which are my 5-month-old birds, mingling with my over a year old birds, and they always are reestablishing pecking order. Who's more dominant? Who's more submissive? But here at my place, you gotta commingle and get along. And for the most part, it's very successful for us. So I think it's because they have ample room to mingle, but again, it's breeds too. Know your breeds. I know a lot of people like to get all the various breeds. They are gorgeous and fun to look at, but then you're going to probably be getting into more issues and kind of maybe some damage as far as, losing feathers or whatnot. So, yeah, great question. Yeah, Turks, he gets along with everybody. Yeah, everybody gets along with Turks.
Karen Krumenacher is the owner of Royal Roost. It's a local consulting service for backyard chicken farmers. She spoke with Joy Powers and Ben Benversi in June. To see photos of some of the animals, including the famous Turks, head to WUWM.com. And that wraps up Tuesday's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.